Good afternoon.
Adam, it's Simon.
Simon.
All right, sorry for a little late.
No problem, my friend. I was just taking a little nap here in my car.
Nice.
So where are you right now?
Dallas, Texas.
Wow. So what is this life you've carved out for yourself? You're traveling around giving these motivational speeches?
Spreading the word. You know, it's, speaking is one of the things I do, and it's all about how to get this message into people's hands.
Right. Right, excellent. So I'd like to start just by, could you just possibly just introduce yourself, a bit about the book that you just published, and then we'll talk a little bit about your background.
So the question I have for you is, are you using the recording for something, or is it just for note-taking purposes?
I think I'm going to upload it as a podcast.
Oh, okay.
If you're cool with that.
Yep.
Fantastic.
I think that I'm in a bit of a blowy area, though. Is it pretty good fun?
I'm in my car, so I sound pretty good. You sound good.
Okay.
So.
Fire away.
Okay, so Simon, tell us a bit about your background. Where did you grow up? And maybe just a bit about some. You told me a little bit about some entrepreneurial activities you originally did, and then we're going to talk a bit about your educational background in anthropology.
Sure. So I'll give you the most recent thing I'm doing, and I'll take you back from there. You know, the most recent thing for me is this book, which is unbelievably exciting. Because it captures a discovery I made about 4 years ago. And what I discovered is that all the great leaders and great organizations, those with the capacity to inspire the people around them, that they all think, act, and communicate the exact same way. Everything from Apple computers to Martin Luther King. And that way is the complete opposite to everybody else. And all I did was codify it. All I did was write it down.
Mm-hmm.
And it profoundly changed my view of how the world works and how organizations work. And it boils it down to three simple ideas. You know, every organization on the planet, even our own careers, function on three levels. What we do, how we do it, and why we do it. What we do, the products we make, you know, the services we sell, how we do it, the things that we can make it different or better. But very few people can put into words why we do what we do. And by why, I don't mean to make money, that's a result. I mean, what's your purpose, what's your cause, what's your belief?
Mm-hmm.
And so the result is that we all obsess about what we do and how we do it. You know, in business we call it strategy and tactics, right? How and what. We don't even have a word in the word for why. And so what I learned is that those organizations and those people that clearly understand why they do what they do, those are the ones who enjoy the long-lasting success. Those are the ones with the capacity to inspire. Those are the ones that build the incredible loyal followings.
Mm-hmm.
And so because it profoundly changed my own life and my own view of the world, what's so exciting about having a book is that I can share that idea with more people than I could ever speak to.
Yeah.
And so that's really my cause, is just to inspire people to do the things that have inspired them, and having an idea in the book is one of the ways I do it.
Awesome. Can you take us back a little bit in your biography?
Yeah, sure. You know, the path was not particularly unusual, quite frankly. About 8 years ago, I started a business. I started a little strategic consultancy. My story's not different than many other people's. I thought I had a better mousetrap, and off I went. And it's exciting for anybody who starts anything on their own. It's an incredibly exciting ride. And, you know, the first year you're running on passion, and you sort of convince a couple of people who to come join you, and that's what we did. That's what I did. And, you know, the second year we did fine, and the third year we did fine. We never run away successful. We made a living. And by the fourth year, I'd beaten the statistic that 90% of most small businesses fail in the first 3 years,
mm-hmm.
which was exciting. But now in the fourth year, something else happened, which is I lost my passion. Even though we were good at what we did, I knew how we were different or how we were better, we had some great clients, I didn't feel it anymore. It wasn't like it started out to be, and I sort of lost the passion and didn't want to get out of bed anymore. I remember the dates, September 05 to December 05. I came the closest if I wasn't completely depressed. And I was tinkering around with an idea that I called the Golden Circle even back then, simply to explain how some marketing worked and some marketing didn't. I was always fascinated how organizations or companies of equal size and equal access equal resources, some were able to communicate in a more powerful way than others. And I noticed that there was a pattern to the way they did it. And it wasn't until someone told me about how the human brain works and the limbic brain and the neocortex and how the human brain actually makes decisions did the discovery happen. And I realized the more I started to learn about the human brain, the way the brain works and the way my little model was articulated, the why, how, and what, perfectly overlapped. In other words, I hadn't discovered why marketing works. I discovered why people do what they do. And that's what profoundly changed my life, which is I became obsessed with why I do what I do and not what I do. Mm. Prior to that, I had a career in marketing, obviously, which is why I went into marketing consulting. And prior to that, I was in law school, thinking I was going to become a barrister and live in England and wear a wig and go to work. But in undergrad, I studied cultural anthropology. And it was then that I think my fascination for why people do what they do really started to, I got to, you know, put a name on it and find out more about culture and what culture means. And the thing that I loved about anthropology was with the flexibility. You know, if you're into psychology, you can study the individual. And if you're into sociology, you can study the group. But anthropology, you have the capacity to understand the whole picture. And that was, it was truly wonderful. I studied ethnography and was a trained ethnographer. And it was really from that training, and really my view on culture and the power of culture and the power of common ideas, was I even able to make the discovery that I did. I'm convinced that if I hadn't studied anthropology in undergrad, that I would never have discovered the Golden Circle, and the life that I'm living now would not exist.
Excellent. So in anthropology, a lot of anthropology professors really shy students away from using cultural anthropology for marketing because they have a certain bias against corporations. Could you maybe respond to a professor that might tell a student that using sort of either this biological knowledge that you know about the limbic brain and how that works in a marketing situation, or sort of like using ethnography to understand a consumer? Could you respond to someone that might have those critiques?
Sure. You know, I think the bias is an academic bias, right?
Yeah.
The value of ideas is that they're practical and usable, you know. Although, I mean, my personal interest in anthropology was not sort of African tribes or Amazonian tribes or where there's only 17 people left, you know. Those are fine academic pursuits, but my interest was more practical. I was interested in Western urban culture. And for an anthropology professor to steer a young anthropologist away from anthropology because of their own, you know, political biases, I think is unfair to the discipline of anthropology. Anthropology is the study of people, the study of culture. And the better we can understand ourselves and the better we can understand culture means that we can produce better marketing and we can produce better political campaigns, not ones that manipulate, but that ones that inspire and give us something to believe in. I think it's because there's a lack of anthropology, quite frankly, in marketing and in politics, that the primary tools used are manipulative. They use things like fear and intimidation and peer pressure to get us to buy things or to get us to vote for somebody. And I think the anthropologist that truly understands that our most basic desire is to belong to something, to feel like we belong to something, means that the kind of marketing that's powerful and positive, you know, Apple Computers, Harley Davidson, their entire cultures that revolve around these companies that the companies did not support with marketing dollars. You know, there are fan clubs and regular meetings and, you know, there's an entire culture that makes people feel like they're a part of something. That's all good, and that's all from anthropology. And the ability for an anthropologist to go into any situation and truly understand what's driving behavior at a visceral level, not at a manipulative level, I think, quite frankly, counteracts all the things that these academics find so repulsive.
Yeah. I'm totally with you on that.
I'm totally serious. I think the more that academics push people, you know, push anthropologists or budding anthropologists away from the business world, all they are doing is perpetuating, you know, the world that they despise. And frankly, if they were smarter and they pushed anthropologists into the business world, then some good things would probably happen. You're working it from the inside out rather than just complaining from the outside, right? Isn't that the whole idea of ethnography?
Totally.
From the inside.
totally. Well, I think that part of the critique is coming from probably a false duality between what they see as being real culture and consumer culture. Consumer culture yeah. being somewhat base and crude, vulgar, cheap and easy. But isn't sort of what we're talking about is, you're talking about like kind of corporate culture is culture. Consumeristic culture is culture. Big capital C.
Absolutely. I mean, what is a culture, right? It's a group of people with a common set of values and beliefs. I mean, that's what a culture is. And we like to align ourselves and associate with people who share our values and share our beliefs for no other reason than it makes us feel safe. It ensures our own personal survival if we live in a community with people with whom we share values and beliefs. That's the importance and value of culture since the dawn of Homo sapiens. And it's called, we are cultural animals. We are social animals. That's what we are, whether we like it or not. And what's a company? You know, it's a group of people with a common set of values and beliefs. What's a city? It's a group of people with a common set of values and beliefs. What's a community? It's a group of people with a common set of values and beliefs. You know, anthropology is not just alive and well, you know, amongst the bongo bongo. It's alive and well wherever there's a collection of people. And so companies that are groups of people, sometimes only a few, sometimes thousands deep, there is culture, and that culture is rich. And the better that culture is managed, quite frankly, the more responsible and the more inspiring these organizations are. You'll find that the most socially responsible companies are the companies that have rich, strong cultures, the ones that manipulate and do poor things and are aggressive and strictly, you know, for the financial gain, you'll find have very poor cultures. Culture doesn't, you know, can be managed or it can be left by default. And quite frankly, it's the cultures that are managed that produce the best companies. And so if the goal is to do good in the world, then understanding how culture works and how a company's culture can be leveraged is, quite frankly, priority number one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always like to say, you know, that 100% of customers are people and 100% of employees are people. And if you don't understand people, you don't understand business. And the study of people is anthropology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. God, awesome. Yes. Well, part of I'm also trying to develop a methodology and then sort of an explanation for doing the type of anthropological research I'm presently doing on social entrepreneurs. And part of what I like to say is that, well, so much of our time is actually spent in professional situations. And with the proliferation of mobile technologies, it seems to me like that 40-hour work week is becoming we're more playful at work in that 40-hour work week, if we're really still doing that, like many of us still are. But then the rest of the week, we're like constantly being accessible. We're constantly accessible because of our mobile technologies. And so what I'm talking about is that the division between work and sort of leisure is sort of conflating, right? And in this new information economy.
Yeah.
So it's not that we're not just studying professional culture or consumeristic culture. It's that professional culture and consumeristic culture has kind of bled over into what we commonly call like real culture, like family and our leisure time and our going to our museums and whatever. All of it sort of seems to be sort of coming together, and we're doing work all the time now, and we're also doing a bit of play while we're working at the same time. Are you noticing some of these trends?
I think it's depending on your perspective, it's either the blessing or the curse of technology.
Right.
Because what technology has done is it's opened up access, right? There was a period not that long ago where the only access you had to the outside world from your office was your telephone or your fax machine, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the only access you had to the office was from home, and that could only be during the week because at night everybody was gone, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what technology has allowed is for blurring of the lines, for the blurring of the access, more importantly. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say it's a blessing and a curse is because, yes, we bring more of our personal lives to the office. You know, we're tweeting, we're on Facebook, we're sending instant messages to our friends, all of these things. You know, some bosses are complaining about that we're having too much of our personal time at work, but mm-hmm. at the same time, equally as balanced, we're accessing our work email we're replying to messages that are being posted that are maybe even intended for the next day while we're at home.
Right.
And so it's probably a wash, you know, and I think those who take time away at work for personal time are probably also taking a time from personal time to do work, which includes weekends and being at movies and things like that, checking in, quote-unquote.
Right.
And I, for one, although I understand the practical value of all of those things, I, for one, feel that it's really important for us to reconnect on a human level, and I think that's one of the things that technology is failing at.
Mm.
You know, there's a reason why the video conference has never replaced the in-person meeting, is because you can't get a read for somebody over a video conference. And again, you know, we're social animals, and it's our ability to read people that is a very important skill for us to find those cultures and find those groups of people with common set of values and beliefs, to find the people we can trust. I mean, if you fly on a plane these days, you know, people are, you know, as soon as they get on, they plug in their iPod or they plug in their headphones into, you know, free television, the live TV or the movies, and nobody has conversations anymore. If you walk down the street and people have headphones on, people sit at bus stops or airports with headphones on, people have their, you know, their phones on their ears or they're sending text messages, they're walking. And I think, quite frankly, that part of the stress that we have in life is that our real social networks, that real culture is breaking down because we falsely believe that technology can replace those things.
Mm.
I mean, you know Dunbar's number that says we can't manage more than 150 relationships at any one time.
Mm.
And what they found is even if you have 10,000 friends on Facebook, you can't manage more than 150 of those relationships at any one time.
Mm.
In other words, the number is constant, on or offline. But we are creating weak bonds with people, even though we might be creating strong bonds online. And those aren't real relationships. You know, even if you meet somebody on Match.com, you still have to go have dinner with them or meet them for coffee before you decide you want to date them or marry them. And I'm sure someone will call in or write in and say, you know, no, I know somebody who they met online, they had a relationship online, and now they're married and very happy. That is by far the exception. Not to mention the fact that the marriage or the relationship survived not because of email, but because eventually they came together, right?
Yeah.
And so technology opens doors, but people have to interact with each other to truly create trusting relationships. And my fear is that the current obsession with social media completely misses the point. It's not a replacement for meeting people. It's in addition to meeting people. It, like I said, it allows for the possibility to meet somebody in a, you know, somebody who lives, you know, 2,000 miles away, and to create a friendship, and it makes the tentacles longer. But at the end of the day, you have to meet the person and know the person and talk to the person in real life to create real relationship, to create real trust, and ultimately grow your community. And it's a tremendous failing of those in the technology world to not see that. I don't rail against social media. I just believe it's not a replacement. It's an addition to.
Excellent. Along those lines, what do you think about exploitative labor in sort of the Web 2.0 world? Like, so it's kind of an old example by now, but, you know, YouTube is sold to Google for a couple billion dollars. Profit is generated, you know, profit is trying to be generated by Google through YouTube based all on user-generated content, a great deal of it. There's some theorists out there that are saying that this is, we at the user-generated content producers should have been cut a part of that $2 billion check that Google cut to the founders of YouTube. How do you see sort of exploitative labor? Do you see social media, users of social media, as sort of a free labor pool? A pool of labor that's
no,
not being...
I think that the criticism is flawed, which is it's not exploitative labor in the sense that you're taking advantage of somebody and forcing them to do something. You know, there's mutual benefit on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Never before has anybody had the capacity to produce a little home video and have a million people see it. You know, there are people who literally become famous, like the guy who wrote who did the song against United Airlines, you know, for breaking his guitar, or the word lady, you know, teaches us a new word every day. I mean, these people have achieved fame from putting up free videos on YouTube. Some of them have even found a way to monetize that.
Yeah.
And the cost of achieving that kind of scale,
mm-hmm.
Would have been prohibitive in a different time period. And so it's a fair deal. You know, YouTube isn't forcing people to do anything. People are taking advantage of YouTube and Google as much as they're taking advantage of us.
Mm-hmm.
They take advantage of us and make money from it, and we take advantage of them and get our messages out there. So it's a fair exchange of consideration, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Very well. So, as I've told you before, my PhD research is on social entrepreneurs, and I've kind of taken this as being my sort of anthropological cultural category. Originally, I was going to look at, like, user-generated content network called Current TV, but then I just thought, well, it's a bigger issue I'm looking at. It's not just one sort of innovative television network. What I really started to compel me about this Al Gore-started user-generated content television network, Current TV, was that it had this social mission, which was to democratize media production, to democratize journalism production. And therefore, when I stepped back and I said, God, really what I'm looking at is this bigger sphere of cultural practice and value system called social entrepreneur, and I started to think, what exactly defines this culture? And I broke it down to basically thinking that maybe it's just about mixed accounting practices, right? It's
yeah.
For profit and it's not for profit.
Well, I mean, you know my opinion about profit and not for profit. I think
yeah.
The language is an incredible debilitator.
Right.
All organizations are for profit. It's just how they measure that profit that's different.
Mm-hmm.
Companies measure their profit in dollars and cents, not-for-profit, so to speak, measure their profit in terms of making it a particular impact in the world, you know?
Yeah.
There's still a measure, but there still has to be progress. There still has to be some sort of, you know, something has to be in the black.
Yes.
It's just the measurement that's different. So I think the do-gooder world does itself a tremendous disservice to call themselves not-for-profit, because what it does is it makes them have an unhealthy relationship with money.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, money is just an enabler, and most not-for-profits spend most of their time raising money anyway.
Right.
So that aside, it's not that aside. So I think what's so fantastic about social entrepreneurship as a culture, as a group of people, is they recognize that there is no such thing as for-profit and not-for-profit. They recognize that it's all for-profit, and they
mm-hmm.
have a healthy relationship with money and understand that money is an enabler. You know, Bill Gates, with his billion that he made in a capitalistic way, is doing more to help the world than you know, some hippie do-gooder throwing Molotov cocktails at a G8 summit. And that's just a fact. And I think
yeah.
what a social entrepreneur does is they recognize the value that a business has because of its ability to produce, quite
yes.
frankly. And if we make some, you know, gross generalizations, in general, the for-profit world is weak on cause and strong on structure, right? They can get things done.
Mm.
And in general, the not-for-profit world is strong on cause and weak on structure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you talk to entrepreneurs all the time, I mean, not-for-profits all the time, and they're carrying a lot of dead weight in terms of talent, but they are loath to fire anybody because they're so devoted to the cause, but in reality, they're bad employees.
Yeah.
A for-profit would have no problem churning out dead wood because they need people who can produce.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a social entrepreneur that understands that what you need to do is combine those models.
Mm.
You need to be strong on cause and strong on structure, not one or the other. One is not better than the other. They have two sides of the same coin. And it's the ability to combine strong structure and processes with strong, clear cause and vision and to have a positive impact in the world, that quite frankly is a new way of doing business and in my opinion is the best way to do business. And if you look at all the for-profit organizations that are more profitable and have a greater impact and command greater loyalty than any of their competitors, they all have a strong sense of cause, every one of them.
Mm-hmm.
The best for-profit organizations function as if they were social movements.
Mm-hmm.
So this concept of social entrepreneurship has existed before. We just didn't have a name for it. We just called those companies the best companies to work for. And we just called their leaders the visionary leaders. But in reality, social entrepreneurship has existed. What
Yes. I love the points you make on that. I had to tee you up so you could repeat it for me again.
Thinking about management, interior to the organization, there's some models that say that what we've been seeing with the new economy, with the information economy, is the emergence of sort of horizontal networking or even consensus-driven or democratically driven management in teams versus the more Fordist model, which is sort of hierarchical, leadership-driven. Can you comment? Have you seen any cool examples of this sort of horizontal management or governance? Do you see it as being an emerging model that you're seeing when you talk to some of these entrepreneurs?
Having a flat organization is a good thing,
yeah.
Where you don't have layers upon layers upon layers of management. However, consensus-driven organizations don't work. Mm. You can't have five chefs in a kitchen. You have to have one chef, and everybody else reports to that chef.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the best form of government is the benevolent dictatorship. The problem is succession. And the same is true in organizations. When they run by consensus, inherently, the whole idea of consensus is the lowest common denominator. How do you please as many people as possible? And so what you end up with is something incredibly, incredibly, incredibly diluted.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if you look at any congressional bill that passes, you know, because they have to get so many people's approval, what you end up with is something that is okay. You know, rare are the bills that are truly profound and great because you have to please as many people and as many constituents as possible. So, this is what leadership is. A leader is the single person, or no more than a pair of people at the top, who explain their vision of the world and ask those in their organizations who believe what they believe to help build it. And consensus is not the way they're driven. There is only one vision, and there can be only one vision. And you know, organizations that fail are the ones where you have two competing visions at the top. They fail.
Mm.
Because it creates loyalties on different sides, it creates competition, it creates unhealthy relationships,
mm-hmm.
and at the end of the day, it splits the culture into factions. You know, again, we're social animals.
Mm-hmm.
We want to belong to things, and when we don't belong to something in one organization, we create a faction of our own, and we follow somebody else. You know, there are camps, and so I'm. The whole idea of consensus management is a fallacy. Even democracies, we still have presidents.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have a leader. You've got to have somebody articulate the vision.
Mm-hmm,
we have to feel like somebody's telling us where to go.
I'm with you.
Can you imagine this country where every decision that was made had to be done by referendum? It wouldn't work.
It would be very slow, wouldn't it?
not only would it be slow, it wouldn't work. And
yeah.
The tactics. I mean, you'd start to see massive amounts of intimidation, you know, at the polling booths.
Right.
And at the end of the day, what a representative government is we believe, we trust that somebody has our beliefs, but we don't micromanage every decision they make. We just trust that because we understand their cause and their vision and their why, that they will govern on our behalf, even if we don't agree with every decision.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the value of any leader, political or business-wise, explaining their why, explaining their cause, explaining why they do what they do, because that's what allows us to let go and trust them.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I know you're right on the leadership angle. I've just been also seeing the emergence on sort of the on the worker level or on the sort of the design level or on the engineering level, a lot of consensus-driven cooperative working schemas that seem to be an emerging model.
Well, my question for you is, what's your definition of consensus? Is your definition of consensus that everybody has a vote, or is your definition of consensus is that everybody's on board?
I think on board, and that the tasks themselves are granular enough that everybody in the group can have the same level of they can all work on the same projects, and they can work on little facets of the projects collectively or individually. And so it's not consensus as far as sort of let's all vote on what we want to accomplish this week, but as far as just doing the work itself, it can be done in small units. It's like an open source model.
Yeah,
Right.
So
everyone can come and contribute.
If I were you, you know, this is the joy of anthropology, which is you can invent your own words, you know? The word consensus is has multiple definitions, and it has baggage. And the problem is, if what you mean by consensus and what I mean by consensus are two different things, then I could never agree with your model because we share a different definition. This is what happened to me with the concept of why.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the reason you never hear me talk about vision, position, brand, any of these words, I just don't use them. And the reason is because there's no standardized definitions of them. You know, when I use the word vision, that could mean 10 different things to 10 different people.
Right.
And at the end of the day, what all of these things are supposed to do is give some explanation of why we do what we do. And so I called it the why, and now we have universal buy-in. It's a single definition. And so I would either invent a word or find a word that has that universal. Open source is a very good word. But I think the ability to get these ideas to catch on is somewhat semantic, you know.
Yeah.
Which is we can't preach consensus based organizations because people who understand consensus differently would never agree to it.
Right.
And not because they don't agree to the principle; they just don't agree with the definition of the word.
Yeah.
But open source is interesting.
Yeah.
But even open source, when you look at things like some of the open source technologies that exist, Google, you know, Mozilla, Craigslist, you know, these companies, Facebook, the reason they've done well is because we understand why the organization exists, and the organization or the technology invites us to participate. And that's the open source part. And I agree with you if that's what you mean by consensus, which is, I belong here, how do I contribute?
Yeah.
That's fascinating. That's
right.
Good stuff.
Right.
But that's not consensus.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I'll take your advice. I'll continue to explore the semantic web I want to use to articulate what I'm exactly looking for. The why is really good. I mean, I've been starting to do my ethnographic interviews, and really, like, when I stumbled for a few of them, and now I realize that it's basically all I'm asking is, why are you doing what you're doing? And I kind of couch it in, you know, your values and how do you account for your worth and those different things. But yeah, basically just getting past the what and the how and getting to the why, such that your book and you articulate, that's basically, it's great ethnographic methodology, really.
Yeah, and there's a little trick, though, as well, which is when you ask somebody why, because it exists in the part of the brain that controls behavior and feelings but not language, when you ask somebody why, it's an emotional question. Inherently, it's an emotional question.
Mm-hmm.
And what's difficult when you ask somebody why is that you're asking them to answer something that they can't put into words, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you ask them what, it's a rational question that goes right to the neocortex.
Mm-hmm.
And so asking somebody a what question, quite frankly, from a research standpoint, from an ethnographic standpoint, elicits greater, much better answers because people are more comfortable saying, you know, if I say, why do you love your wife? It's a really hard question,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
If I ask you, what is it about your wife that you love? That's a very easy question.
Yeah.
One is tangible, one is intangible. And so even though you're in pursuit of why, you actually will have better luck asking what questions.
Totally.
It allows people to more easily answer them, and it's that moving deeper and deeper and deeper, keep asking them what, that eventually they get to a level where they can't go any deeper and they start talking about themselves, and that's when you know when they're starting to answer the question why. ironically, you can't actually ask people why, you have to ask them what's easier for them to answer.
Oh, you're so
yeah,
right.
As an ethnographer, we are in search of why, but we actually ask what.
Totally. God, you're totally right on about that. It's true. If you open with the why question right in the first 5 seconds, 5 minutes,
oh,
you could totally...
I disagree. I usually open with the what question in the first 5 minutes.
No, I'm saying...
The why question.
No, I agree. I'm saying when I screw up and I try to ask the why question immediately,
yes.
I can stump them, you know?
Yes.
And you've got to work through what we call in anthropology, the practices, the thing that people know what they do with their body, and that's then the key or the doors begins to open into the why. So cool. So concluding, what advice would you give an anthropologist studying social entrepreneurs from the level of who I could talk to, what corporations I could, taking into account access issues, and finally, you know, maybe... I mean, you've given me such great advice methodologically and theoretically, but if you want to continue on that, that's cool too.
Ethnography is becoming a more common practice in the marketing world,
mm-hmm.
and you'll find companies and agencies hiring ethnographers, even employing ethnographers, to go and explore the cultures of some particular audience.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a long, long time ago, in a former life, when I worked in the ad business, we did some work for an international airline, we wanted to understand the international business traveler. So the common practice in marketing is to have a focus group, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pull together a focus group and ask these people, you know, what's so great about business. But the problem is, they don't know.
Right.
And what we did was we hired an ethnographer, and we put them on business class and to travel to and from Asia multiple times, sitting next to business travelers and watching them and talking to them.
Wow.
And seeing that the things that they're saying and the things that they're doing are not the same. In other words, you ask a business traveler what's important to you, and they tell you the importance is having, you know, internet access and all of these things. But in reality, we found that when they travel on these long trips, they actually bring stacks of magazines and books that they've been trying to catch up with for months and haven't had time, and they can't wait for their international trip because they can have some time where nobody can talk to them and nobody can access them, and they can't email anybody, and nobody can call them. And so we found out that their behavior is actually very different.
Yeah.
And so the whole way we marketed the product was, you know, private time, your time, not more business, which, even though that's what they said, that's not what they meant, and that could not have come from anything else but anthropology, from ethnography.
Mm-hmm.
So you can find, if you go to a lot of the packaged goods companies and talk to their marketing people, I promise you that they probably work with ethnographers, you know, or are currently working with them. For those anthropologists, you know, there's a world out there that is more actionable, more practical than studying, you know, dying tribes in the Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it has an academic value,
mm-hmm.
but it has no practical value.
Right.
I think there's more. I mean, you look at somebody like William Ury, right? The guy who wrote Getting to Yes.
Yeah.
He's become, you know, an expert in negotiation and has been involved in the negotiation of very, very significant peace deals between Arabs and Israelis and in Venezuela and the Janjaweed and Somalia. Well, guess what? William Ury is an anthropologist.
Hmm.
And while studying tribes around the world, he saw that the way that they solve problems was applicable in our world, and he became an expert in negotiation because he's an anthropologist.
Hmm.
And I think it's these broad applications and practical applications of ethnography and anthropology and the ability to understand why people do what they do, that, quite frankly, we need more anthropologists.
Yes. Simon, you're a rock star, buddy. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem, Adam. I hope that helps. And if you want to have any follow-up questions or discussion, let me know. I'm happy to help, okay?
God, I would love to, my friend. It's really...
There was some nice stuff in there. Can you give me a copy of the recording?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.